Officials from about 70 countries and organizations gathered in London this past week to discuss how to wind down the Afghanistan war, based on President Obama's pledge last year to start withdrawing troops by 2011. The summit was attended by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, as well as Afghan President Hamid Karzai, who proposed peace talks with the Taliban. While the U.S. responded negatively to any reconciliation with the Taliban, there is some acquiescence on so-called reintegration of low-level fighters. Meanwhile, as increased numbers of U.S. and NATO troops are actively engaged in the war, part of their mission is a vague and sometimes clumsy mandate to provide aid. Recently, a number of prominent aid organizations active in Afghanistan released a report harshly criticizing the militarization of aid, asserting that it is unethical, often misplaced, wrongly used as a tool to glean intelligence, and endangers the lives of aid workers and ordinary Afghans. On the other hand, when U.S. troops are not providing aid, they're carrying out disturbingly destructive nighttime raids in villages, apparently arbitrarily executing civilians, sometimes youth, and detaining them in secret prisons. Afghanistan-based reporter Anand Gopal has just completed a detailed investigative report of the raids in prisons, and he now joins me on the phone. Tell us first a little bit about your investigation of these so-called night raids that take place in Afghanistan. How typical are they, and how does a night raid usually go? What is the sort of anatomy of one, if you will?
Well, I was very interested in the issue of civilian casualties, and we hear a lot about airstrikes and the anger that that causes in Afghanistan. But when I was going around the country and speaking to Afghans, what surprised me is it was actually night raids, which are raids done by U.S. soldiers, or usually special forces soldiers, in the middle of the night, and usually they break into people's houses and take people away to interrogate them. This was sort of the most contentious issue in the rural areas of Afghanistan.
And who exactly is doing this? Is it under NATO or is it U.S. troops?
Well, it's complicated because the U.S., part of the U.S. troops are under NATO, and then part of them, the special forces, that's like the Green Berets and the Navy SEALs, et cetera, they sort of operate more independently. And so most of the night raids, especially the more egregious ones, the ones where they're breaking into the houses and sometimes people are being killed in the process, those are often done by U.S. Special Forces.
And is there any sort of method to who is targeted, whose homes are entered, and who is even, for that matter, actually killed? Because in the course of these raids, as you've written, people are getting killed left, right, and center.
Well, often the U.S. Army will go into a village and get attacked by the Taliban. And it's very hard, it's very difficult for the U.S. soldiers to then determine where that attack came from or who amongst the villagers assisted in that attack. But the night raids are, I mean, the purpose of the night raids is sort of find that out. Often they'll act on intelligence, often faulty intelligence, that tells them that person A or person B was perhaps involved in the attack. Or more generally, sometimes they'll get intelligence that a certain person is associated with the insurgency or is a bomb maker or has been laying roadside bombs. Often this intelligence is given by other Afghans who have their own rivalries and feuds. And many times they'll use the U.S. Troops to sort of get back at their rivals in this way.
Tell us where people are taken. I mean, when people think about here in the United States about detention facilities in Afghanistan, we often simply think of Bagram, but you're writing that there are secret prisons that nobody really knows much about, especially outside the United States, but even in Afghanistan, they're very secretive.
That's right. Usually after somebody's apprehended, they're taken to a series of small field prisons that are on U.S. military bases. And these are pretty secretive, and they're held there for 3 or 4 or 5 days. And that's where the bulk of the interrogation of suspects takes place. And historically, it's usually been in those field prisons or en route to those prisons where there's been allegations of abuse. And at that point, after they're held in these field prisons, then some of them are then sent on to Bagram.
What sort of abuse are we talking about here? And can you also tell us who you interviewed for your investigation?
Well, I interviewed nearly two dozen former detainees and even more family members of current detainees. And they alleged also, abuse ranging from slapping and punching and kicking to much more serious charges. I interviewed one person who accuses U.S. interrogators of using some form of waterboarding and forced swallowing of water. There's also some instances of people even being killed in interrogation. So it really runs the gamut.
And the waterboarding issue and the forced swallowing of water, is this the person named Sher Khan that you interviewed?
That's right, yes.
So this sort of treatment is now supposed to be illegal. What's the time frame that the abuses took place of the people that you interviewed? Is it something that sort of has happened in the recent past, or is it ongoing?
Well, the worst abuses took place in the first 3 or 4 years after 2001, and it has diminished to an extent in the last couple of years. There are some still ongoing accusations of abuse, especially in these smaller field prisons. In Bagram, the main prison in Bagram, most people, detainees and others who are involved with their cases say that abuse there has almost entirely stopped.
And what exactly goes on in these secret prisons, if we even know? And do you have any idea from your interviews where any of these might be located?
We know where some of them are because, as I mentioned, they are on U.S. military bases, so we know where the bases are. But there are some that are not on U.S. bases, and there are some probably that exist that none of us even know about at all. There's one that's on an Afghan army base, for example. And in these prisons, mostly it's interrogations that are they're not used for long-term detentions. If they feel that somebody should be detained for a long period of time beyond, let's say, a week, and then they'll move them away from these small prisons and send them to Bagram.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Afghanistan-based reporter Anand Gopal. He writes in a number of publications, including the Wall Street Journal and the Christian Science Monitor. He's just finished an investigative report called Obama's Secret Prisons, Night Raids, Hidden Detention Centers, the Black Jail, and the Dogs of War in Afghanistan. What is the Black Jail?
The Black Jail is an interrogation site which is on Bagram, but it's separate from the main Bagram prison. The main Bagram prison is something that's known and it's been documented what goes on there, and the Red Cross has access to it. The Black Jail is a separate prison that the Red Cross doesn't have access to, and this is something that's run by the special forces. And it's the conditions there are much more harsh than the regular prisons. People, former detainees, have said that they were held in solitary confinement for a long period of time. They were accused interrogators of abusing them as well.
Now, a few weeks ago, there was some reports of the execution of some teenage boys at the hands of U.S. soldiers, part of these raids, if you will. What sort of treatment, or what did you turn up in your investigation about how the U.S. troops during these raids treat youth, young people, and even children in Afghanistan?
Well, there's often no distinction that's made between, definitely between teenagers and adults. And, you know, the circumstances of these raids, they're in the middle of the night, and soldiers, I've talked to soldiers who've gone on these raids, and they talk about how their adrenaline's pumping, and they're on the lookout for enemy fire or anybody hiding in one of the rooms, and they jump out and shoot at them. So they're not really in the state of mind to discriminate between teenagers and adults. And there have been, over the years, there have been a number of children under the age of 18 that have been taken in night raids and incarcerated. I believe today in Bagram there's only one child left, but this is a much bigger problem in the years especially the years right after the invasion.
And what has the response of the Afghan government and even local governments been to these raids? Do they have any power? And presumably people are complaining about them and speaking up about them as best they can.
They are, and it's really been the sticking point between the Afghan government and coalition forces, because the government feels that this is something that undermines the support from the local population of the government. And they've pushed to get the Afghan security forces, such as the Afghan army, to be involved in house searches as a way of sort of limiting the accesses of them. But the U.S. special forces sort of operate outside of all of that and don't answer directly to the Afghan government, and therefore sort of there are very few controls from the Afghan side in terms of trying to stop the excesses.
I want to turn to a related matter in Afghanistan, Anand. Since the U.S.'s occupation began, one of the things that troubled aid organizations that have been operating in many parts of Afghanistan has been the militarization of aid. And I'm wondering if you've seen the new report that was just put out by a conglomeration of aid agencies, including Oxfam, ActionAid, and others, that it's called Quick Impact, Quick Collapse, The Dangers of Militarized Aid in Afghanistan, and how aid sort of sometimes gets used as a tool by troops. In your research and work on the ground in Afghanistan, were you able to corroborate some of the allegations made by these aid agencies about how aid is used as a military tool?
Well, yeah, certainly. One of the main ways in which the coalition forces try to win over the local population is by creating development projects, and these are usually what they call quick impact projects, such as building a well or building a school. But it's done in such a way that it's often not even something that the local community has asked for. I've seen cases where they've gone in and built a school when the community already had a school, and it's wasted millions of dollars of taxpayer money. Beyond that, there's something called the provincial reconstruction teams, which operate throughout the country. And these are sort of military outfits that go and also sort of double as reconstruction teams. And they go and try to bring development. But the problem becomes that most aid organizations are very reluctant to work with them because they're seen as being just part of the U.S. military force. And right now, the U.S. military isn't very popular in the Pashtun countryside. So it's seen as actually undermining the work of aid groups. And so you've seen there's cases where aid organizations working in these conflict zones actually get attacked because they're seen as part and parcel with the U.S. military and not something that's independent.
Now, while all of these things are happening on the ground in Afghanistan, Western leaders who can seem so disconnected from what's really happening, if you listen to the words of President Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, leaders have been meeting this week at a conference in London on Afghanistan, agreeing for a timetable for the handover of security duties in Afghan provinces starting in late 2010, later this year or early next year. And I'm wondering if you've been following their work at this conference. Is there any proposal, or do you think, you know, what do you think of what's happening in Afghanistan, given your intimate knowledge of what's happening on the ground?
Well, there's a lot of talk in the conference, like you said, about working to hand over responsibilities to the Afghan security forces, but most realistic estimates of the appraisals of the Afghan security forces say that they are nowhere near ready to begin to take anything over, especially the Afghan police, which are widely seen as corrupt and inefficient and hated by the local population. It would take years and years before the Afghan security forces can actually take control of security. And also in the conference, there's a lot of talk about negotiating with the Taliban, which a lot of Afghans support, except that the sort of negotiation that they're talking about in the conference is more a surrender, asking for Taliban fighters to put their weapons down and join the government versus sort of both sides coming together and trying to come up with a mutually agreeable solution. And I think since that's the case, then it may not be the most efficient way forward.
What do you think, given what you've seen on the ground of the practicality of peace talks with the Taliban, even if the NATO countries were to come to such negotiations with a good faith effort, certainly it could start the process for withdrawal of troops, but that would leave an Afghanistan with the Taliban in power, at least with some power, not unlike the way in which it was in 2001. It would also leave human rights and women's rights and, you know, in general, in a precarious position.
Well, yeah, that's right. And especially a lot of urban women have been very worried about any prospect of the Taliban coming back into power. But, you know, I think these concerns are valid, but the other side of the coin, which is the government side, which contains a lot of warlords and a lot of shady characters, there's a lot of human rights concerns on that side as well. Many of the worst abuses, even against women, were committed by warlords who were fighting against each other in the mid-90s and today have some position in government. So
any post-occupation government would consist of basically the Taliban and the warlords, none of whom have any kind of a record of human rights.
No, none of them have a record of human rights. And this is,
but neither does the U.S. military.
Right. So there's no real alternatives on offer for Afghans, which is a problem.
What do you make of the potential for grassroots movements in Afghanistan, dismal as that can potentially be given how poor the country is, but a sort of third alternative? There were elections last year in which, you know, some figures did emerge as being independent.
Unfortunately, I do think the prospects are slim just because the country is so underdeveloped and has been so ravaged by war for more than 30 years. So civil society doesn't really exist outside of a couple of cities. If you go into the rural countryside, the only political force is the Taliban. There's nothing else. And it's for that reason that people sometimes end up joining or supporting the Taliban, not out of any deeply felt sympathy to their ideology, but because there's really no other alternatives on offer.
Well, Anand Gopal, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Anand Gopal is an Afghanistan-based reporter who has written for The Wall Street Journal, Christian Science Monitor, and other publications. He's just finished a detailed investigative report of nighttime raids and secret prisons in Afghanistan. And his piece was published in Tom Dispatch. We'll post it on our website later today at kpfk.org/uprising.